that, dear listeners, was the bhajan workshop which was conducted as part of the summer course in the year 2015. For those of you who follow our bhajan quiz and who participate in that, just a reminder, the bhajan quiz for this time is you have to send bhajans which have all the lines ending with the word Om. So if you have a bhajan, or if you have a list of bhajans which can be answered to that question, you can send it to the bhajan quiz, the quiz email ID, as you always send it to. It's now time for us to move on to the next program of today, the Shravanam, Mananam, Nididhyasanam section. So in a short while, me and Brother Hari from the Sri Sat Sahasrar Trust will be taking you all to the next program of today, Shravanam, Mananam, Nididhyasanam.
Tune into Sai. Spend the day with Sai. From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Stay tuned.
Offering our loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, we welcome your listeners to this week's Shravanam, Mananam, Nididhyasanam. It's a program where we take Swami's discourses and play them in short bits and try to understand what Swami says there through a short discussion between two of us here in the studio here. We're going through the 1991 Summer Course series. We are going through the sixth discourse in that series. This discourse is about the Upanishad called Prashnopanishad. In fact, I think we're going to stay in Prashnopanishad for quite a while, because the next few discourses are also about this very Upanishad. So to discuss about what we played last week, we played a very beautiful and profound clip from the discourse. To kind of summarize what Swami said in that clip and to go on with this week's program, let me invite Brother Hari to join all of us. Sairam Hari.
Sairam Prem. Good evening.
And as I was saying, that the clip which we played last time, there were three or four very distinct themes that Swami spoke about, and very, very important ones. Just to refresh what Swami said there, I think one of those things which Swami spoke about was what we refer to as the three D's, right? Devotion, discrimination, and determination. And Swami was speaking of how that is very important, especially when you have a certain goal, when you have a certain question that you seek answers for, how these three are very, very important. That was one thing Swami spoke about in that discourse.
Yes.
And of course, he broke up and spoke about each one of those things. And devotion, and when he was speaking about devotion, he was talking about how it is not merely the idea of bhakti. Swami was not talking of devotion in that connotation. Swami is talking about having that sense of dedication to the cause, or when you take up something, to be focused on that. And as Swami said, you kind of hold on to that in spite of whatever other tribulations that come your way. And that sincerity is what is necessary for you to eventually find the answer or reach the destination. And then Swami was talking about discrimination. And Swami was talking, he beautifully spoke about how discrimination has got to be universal, or the result of a discrimination should be universal. If I sit and discriminate in a situation I am in, or if I'm in a dilemma and I think of it, the answer that I come up with should be the same as the answer anybody in any part of the world will come up with if they are put in the same situation.
And also with respect to time, like it shouldn't...
Exactly.
As time alters, like we say, relative values change.
Right, right.
But Swami is looking at a higher, principle than that. And I think one thing that stood out, in what Swami said last time, and I think that's where we kind of, wound up last time, was Swami speaking about, how we should be courageous enough to stand up for these principles, for these values, right? And we were saying, how many times, for the sake of our survival or whatever, survival I don't mean at the physical level, but survival of our, say, financial security or so many, our fame, and we are ready to compromise these values, right, for those, but Swami is asking us to stand beyond that, we see at least in India, we are bred on these stories of, say, Satya Harishchandra.
Right.
We see that the ideal that is placed in front of us is, yes, if you stand for the truth, you may undergo a lot of tribulations, but you know, you are bigger than any of that.
Right.
And God ultimately recognizes that person who holds on to these in spite of all the waves of troubles, worries that come. I think that was
this is problem with most of these stories, as I've seen them. When you listen to them, especially like stories like Satya Harishchandra and things like that, I mean, it's very inspiring to hear it. But when you notice our thinking when we listen to a story like that, you know, we kind of internally know that there is going to be a good ending to that.
Yes, right? Absolutely, very
so
good point.
So invariably, we are kind of our focus is on that.
Right.
There is a good ending, so let's wait for the good ending.
Right.
We almost mentally jog through the part where the sacrifices are made, or you know, the situation is really faced square on.
Yeah.
And many times in life, when you go through, especially when you become a principled person and you're trying to live a principled life, you don't always find those good endings coming to you very often. Right.
You
don't have a complete story all the time.
Yeah. Because one thing is, we cannot equate these to that. You know, when a life, a transformed life, does not necessarily equate to a very good life.
Right.
And a transformed life is led for the sake of a transformed life and nothing else.
Right.
Or if you want to see it from another perspective, it is like you are acknowledging, like what Swami has said, that you are the divine principle in a body, you know, not just an animal that is inhabiting a body that is upright.
Right.
When you stand for that, when you accept that the guru, what the guru has said is true, then the rest of it follows.
Right.
You know, that you don't compromise on the values that he has said. But I think the what the stories convey to us is that we must keep our mind anchored in God.
Right.
As, like last time we had spoken about how Brother Satyajit had once told, you know, this was the interaction I had with him, and he told me this, that Swami will often put you in situations where there's a toss-up. It's a toss-up between God and the world, or Swami and the world. So you choose Swami and you'll always be, you know, on the right side.
Right.
So that I think that was where we kind of wound up.
Right.
There's a bit, yeah, sorry.
Sorry, I mean, there was another part which we played, but we did not speak much about.
Yes.
Because it was a theme in itself, and we wanted to take a little more time in that, because Swami was talking about how the imbalance in our approach towards rights and responsibilities is actually one of the major problems in, you know, modern culture and younger generations.
Yeah.
And that is a theme which Swami speaks a lot about.
Mm.
In fact, I was just going through randomly Swami's discourses.
Mm.
You know, nowhere Swami says that you don't have rights.
Mm.
Right? Swami never says that. You only focus on responsibilities, only talk about duties. Swami doesn't say that. Swami says, you know, rights will be given if you focus on responsibilities.
Precisely. Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And you don't have a right over rights as long as you're not, you know, focusing on the responsibilities.
Correct. I think there's a very important message, especially for present day society, where a lot of, I mean, without doubt, I mean, as you rightly said, Swami has not said that rights are not important. But I think we do take it too far, you know, from time to time. And I think, like, the present, it's a translation of our self-obsession.
Mm.
Right? We are so focused on what we want, what we need. Right? And I think the cure for that is Swami saying that that you got to look beyond that and towards what your responsibilities are.
Right.
And I think this Swami very often, you know, he used to talk to us about episodes from the Ramayana, for instance. And the Ramayana, if you see, almost every relation or every character in that is very, very conscious of what his duties, what his responsibilities are. You know, that is the core message of Ramayana, really, is that. And that even it when it comes to Lord Rama, right, in various instances we see that this is the Lord incarnated in human form, and yet follows is the embodiment of you know, somebody who sticks to his duties, responsibilities. Right. I think one of the key episodes early in the in Ramayana is how when Vishwamitra, he comes to the court and he asks for the right. two young students, and he says, "I will train you." And Lord Rama, in all humility, he undergoes that period where he becomes a disciple and he has a human as his guru, right? And completely respects the word that his father has given the guru, right? Whereas he can say, "I'm the Lord, I'm exempt from all this." Mm. But he showed us, you know, that the I think the biggest lesson, pran jaye par vachan na jaye, right? The word that I've given, I may lose my life, but I will not let that word be broken.
Mm. The other point, talking about the Ramayana, I mean that discussion with when Rama is going away to the forest, he goes to Mother Kaushalya and he tells her that you will have to stay back and take care of father.
Yeah.
You know, that's your duty. Your duty is first as a wife. You know, though you would love to come with me, as you know, as Mother Kaushalya says, Rama tells her that that's not the right thing to do.
Mm.
So then he comes to Mother Sita and tells her that why don't you go back to your parents, place and stay there for this period of 14 years. I have been banished. You are not bound to come with me.
Hmm.
So at that time, Mother Sita, you know, refers to this advice that he gave to Kaushalya. He says that, you know, the same thing which applies to her applies to me also.
Hmm.
You know, here you can't talk about my rights. You have to talk about my responsibilities, and my responsibility happens to be what I like doing right now, coming with you. So, you know, you can't take that away from me. And finally, that's an argument which wins her the opportunity to go with. I mean, as you're saying, that each of these characters, especially in the Ramayana, really stands for, you know, constantly asking themselves what is the responsibility that they have. In fact, that very, very classic debate between Rama and Bharata, when Bharata says that I will serve for 14 years in the forest, you go back and rule. And, finally, Rama has nothing to say. And they turn to King Janaka and they ask Janaka what is his verdict, right? So at that time, King Janaka says, look, love is beyond all duty, right? So love is supreme. So what love seeks should have precedence over anything else.
Mm.
So more or less everybody is resigned to the fact that, you know, Bharata has won his debate. So he gets to go his way. But then Janaka gives a twist, and he says, even love has its duty, right? So when it's bhakti, the duty of bhakti is obedience.
Mm.
So even giving up one's own liking and one's own desires for the sake of the one who is the object of that love becomes the duty of love.
Right. Yes.
So then he says, Varta, don't ask what you want to do. Ask Rama what he wants to do and follow it, even if it is painful.
Yes.
So that emphasis on duty is absolutely, as you said, is very, very distinct in the Ramayana.
Right. And also, I think the subtle message that is conveyed in that all this, there is an element of sacrifice that is involved.
Right.
And when Swami speaks about the role of Kaikeyi, I think that is where we see the embodiment of sacrifice. I think she is the one who performs the highest sacrifice from Swami's point of view in the Ramayana.
Right.
We normally when we read the Ramayana, the usual rendering of that story, we look at her as a villainous character,
right.
That one who is taken over with the she is lost in her love for her son,
right.
So much so that she forgets and she is even ready to victimize the Lord himself. But Swami says, and he puts this perspective, that she volunteered for this.
Right.
And she knew that it was part of the character that she had to play. And that's where we see, you know, that this is a case where what she sacrificed was perhaps more than anything anyone else did. It's more than sacrificing her life. She was ready to sacrifice her own reputation for the sake of what the Lord needed at that time. And reputation, I think, is far greater than life itself. So she was ready to sacrifice even that. And in that doing that, she discharged her duty to the Lord.
Right.
Because that was what was required of her. So in many things, see, it's very interesting what you spoke about Sita and Rama. Like, if I look at it from a modern perspective, right, somebody would say that, where is the love in this? Mm-hmm. Where's the element of romance in their relationship? If everything is cast in the terms of I have a duty to you and then you have a duty to me, like where is the relationship? But then it is very clear statement that relationship is something that is beyond feelings. It has to last beyond the feelings themselves. Maybe initial spark is there. It's like, you know, many a times if somebody asks us, does your mother love you? And then you say, yes, of course my mother loves me. But in the Indian context, most mothers, like at least in my generation, have never heard my mother say, I love you. Or, you know, come and hug me. Or none of that. There's absolutely no demonstration of affection. If anything, she was very strict with, you know, most mothers.
You get spanked.
Spanking and everything that went with, you know, that what was considered appropriate in that generation. And yet, if somebody asks me, I would say without doubt, yes. Because what she did was her duty, no matter what. Whether she was sick, whether she was feeling down, you know, whatever it was, she delivered on whatever she had to do. You know, so that, I think, that element of performing the duty no matter under what circumstances, that demonstrates the highest love and not the pronouncement.
What you said is very, very interesting, especially about, you know, mothers delivering on the duty and standing to that. See, I mean, it's one thing to say that they were dutiful and they, you know, did their duty, but it goes without saying that that kind of perfection and duty came because of the love.
Yes.
It's impossible without that love. And, you know, that's why we see only the duty part and we think that, they were just dutiful individuals.
No.
But that duty itself is not possible if not for that love.
Precisely.
And that love expressed itself as that readiness to do the duty without any complaining, without any, you know, what about myself, my space, my likes and dislikes.
They would often complain saying that we never get a holiday. You may get a holiday, but we don't get a holiday.
But they never want a holiday. Right? They will never really ask for one. Because not suggesting that, take that for granted as sons and daughters. But I mean, as you said, one more thing which when you're talking about rights and responsibilities, you know, I comes to my mind is the way Swami would pass on this idea to the students. I remember coming across a discourse, I think maybe in the early 70s, that must have been the early years of Swami's educational institutions. When Swami was talking to the students and Swami was telling, what is our university, what is our college about? Right? And there he makes the statement that, you know, in the society there is a pool of resources. Right? There are opportunities available in a let's say a dump or a pool or something like that. Nowadays education is seen as how well equipped you are to go and grab your share from that.
Yes.
Right? How much more can you equip yourself so that you can grab more and more from that pool of resources?
Yes.
Swami said, here we will not teach you that. Here our emphasis will be, how can you go out and contribute to the society?
Precisely.
So he said, keep this in mind and learn whatever you learn with this attitude. That you are going to be empowered to go out and do to the society what you owe to the society and not grab from that pool which everybody is trying to grab from.
Yes, so it just so logically flows from this that now the entire conversation about responsibilities and rights, it actually fits into what Swami said right at the beginning of this discourse. Right? He says, Paropakarartham idam sharinam. So what Swami is leading us towards is this, that your life is truly meaningful when it is a life of service. In fact, we touched upon this theme maybe 2 or 3 episodes back, where, you know, Swami was speaking about, like, when is it that you get true joy, or what is the true purpose? The question that Swami was addressing is, like, what is the true purpose of life, right? And then we saw Swami is very clearly saying that the purpose for which you are born is to serve society, is to live for the welfare of others. And that is what I think, like, so the whole, you know, the idea of, I think, Ramayana is essentially that. It conveys that a life of service is what makes life sacred.
Right.
And I, in fact, you know, a few days ago, I was speaking to someone and he was saying, you know, he is talking about his relationship with his wife. And he says, you know, over, he was just looking back at what is it that kept their relationship alive? No matter what the ups and downs, you know, the several fights that they had, and you know, several times you get annoyed with your spouse. Mm. And then how do you keep it together, right? And he said, at all those times, I reminded myself that this marriage is about my duty to care for her.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I decided to take on like this, that I am here to serve my wife. Which is a very astonishing, you know, reversal of roles. I don't even know if what society would look upon it as. But this is what he said, kept it alive. He decided that he would be of service to her. That her father has handed over her to me so that I can take care of her.
Yeah.
And that attitude of service, he says, no matter what she says, no matter what she does, how annoying it is, I can still find myself that space where I can love her back. And that is, I think, that was a very powerful statement that he made, but so much in keeping, you know, with what Swami is talking about, that your life is, you know, that you think about what your responsibilities are rather than your rights. I think that would cure a lot of divorces.
We talk of spirituality in different dimensions, but if you're talking about practical spirituality, how to start today,
exactly.
I think it's a perfect way to start.
Yeah.
I mean, look at ourselves, look at the roles we play, look at you know, the opportunities which we grab, and ask ourselves, can we consciously move towards that, you know, duty focused life or responsibility focused life?
Yeah.
That will be a perfect place to start with, and a very, very practical thing to do with everyday life.
Yes. Also, look at this important thing, that no matter what we conceive ourselves to be, right? Say, I as Harishankar, I conceive myself I think of myself in a certain way. And yet, how does the world know me? The world knows me by my commitments. So, I stay at home with my father, and so my father knows me as my commitments towards him. And when I come to the office, I have certain commitments to my boss, to my superiors, to my peers around me. And anywhere you go, ultimately we have commitments, and people know us by that, right? And say a teacher is there, she walks into a school, and there is a certain commitment that society, the students, the parents of those students, they all expect them to fulfill, right? And you're looked upon, you're called a teacher when you fulfill on those commitments. And what are you apart from commitments? It's, you know, if you look at it that way, that's all you are. You are your commitments to the people around you. Right? And that's what Swami is trying to have us be so aware, so, you know, open our eyes and see, right? That all the while when you're focused at me, like who you truly are, I mean, I'm not saying truly are, but what you are in one sense is a set of commitments.
Right.
And that's why, you know, a lot of us find that imbalance in our lives, that sense of not feeling fulfilled or having a break in relationships with people. And that is because we are not following up on our commitments. We are not staying true to that.
Right. There's another statement which Swami made, I mean, in the same context, in the light of what we were speaking till now. Tempted to go into that, where Swami speaks about end of wisdom is freedom, and end of culture is perfection, end of knowledge is love.
Right.
It's a very, very profound couple of statements, but I'll refrain from going into that. We'll play the discourse for today. We'll go through what Swami has to say in that. Maybe in the context of what Swami is saying now, if it comes up, we'll speak about it. Otherwise, in the next week when we summarize, we can always touch about that, because that's a concept which, you know, some of these themes that Swami speaks about so beautifully weds normal physical and practical life which we go through, and the highest of philosophies, in a very, very seamless manner. I think some of these statements are like that. But as I said, we'll go through the discourse first, the clip for today, and we will see what Swami has to say today.
So students, in our life, to recognize life's purpose, these six students put forth six questions. Pipilada gave precise answers for each of these questions.
ఈ కవి ప్రభావాన్ని ముంచేటువంటి ఈ విద్యార్థులు ఎందు ఎంతైనా అవసరం. ఎందుకంటే కలి ప్రభావానికి గురి అవుతున్నారు విద్యార్థులు.
These answers are vital to today's students who are being drowned in the negative influences of the Kali Yuga. Because students are falling prey to these negative influences of Kali, students are acting according to place, time and situation. They are not looking into their hearts and inquiring. We are only looking outward. We are fostering merely the vision that focuses outward. We must cultivate inner vision too. The influence of inner vision would turn itself into outer perspective. That is what is referred to as reflection of inner being. We need this reflection of inner being. Only then our balance would be perfect. Students possess immense intelligence. But they are not developing this intelligence properly. We are not skilling it in the right manner. We are killing that intelligence. And because we kill, this balance is lost. So, we must primarily keep this balance in a proper manner. For that, we need to develop our inner feelings. This is a tree. The tree has borne some fruits. The shadow of the tree is here. If we climb merely the shadow, we attain only the shadow fruits. But we do not get the fruits from the real tree. This is the true one. This is reality and that is shadow. Today we are following only the shadow. Because we are after the shadow tree, we only get the shadow fruits. But when we keep climbing the real tree, we will climb the shadow too. The shadow gets the shadow fruit and in reality you get the real fruit. So the object gets the object, the reflection gets the reflection. So that path which when followed would enable us to follow both paths simultaneously, we must pursue that. So, we must follow reality. We must follow our heart. Once we follow this, we will be able to attain the right state. Students,
ఈనాడు ఈ లోకమునకు ఇలాంటి విద్యార్థులు ఎంతైనా అవసరం.
Such type of students are very much necessary for today's world.
విద్యార్థులు చాలా మంచివారే.
Students are indeed very good.
విద్యార్థులు గుణగణములు కలిగినటువంటి వారే.
Students have good qualities and ideals.
కానీ వారిని కొంతవరకు అనుసరింపజేసేటువంటి వారిలో ఉంటుంది దోషాలు.
But the mistakes lie with those who are guiding them.
బయట వాతావరణం చాలా మాలిన్యంగా ఉంటుంటారు.
Outside environment is very impure.
ఎంత మాలిన్యంగా ఉన్నప్పటికీ మీ హృదయాలు పరిశుద్ధంగా ఉంటే ఎటువంటి దీంట్లోపల కూడా మనం ప్రవేశించి విజయాన్ని సాధించవచ్చు.
However impure it may be, if your hearts are pure, you can take on any scenario and be victorious.
ఆ ధైర్యాన్ని మొట్ట విశ్వాసాన్ని పెట్టుకోవాలి.
You need to have such courage and faith.
What about self-confidence?
So self-confidence is foremost. That self-confidence is the foundation of our life. Only when self-confidence is there as the firm foundation, we can build self-satisfaction as the walls. When the walls of self-satisfaction are well protected, the roof of self-sacrifice can be erected. Once we have built the roof of self-sacrifice, you can enjoy self-realization. So, self-confidence, self-satisfaction, self-sacrifice and self-realization. But
confidence, satisfaction, sacrifice, realization. In annitikini mundu self anu.
In each of these, confidence, satisfaction, sacrifice and realization, the word preceding is self. Who is this self? We must recognize that first. Without self, where does self-confidence come from? Without self, where does satisfaction come from? Without self, what sacrifice can you do? Without self, what will you realize? For all of these, self is of prime importance. What is that self? That is the true Atma Tattva. These are all matter. These are all based.
Self adharam.
Self is the basis.
Self pranamu.
Self is the life force. All these are life forms. Only from life principle, life is obtained. So firstly, we need to keep the self in a right manner. Self should always remain as self. In no way it should undergo any change. But once it becomes selfish, it degrades. That is why it is said, fish is better than selfish. We shouldn't become selfish.
Self lives by giving and forgiving.
Self is giving and forgiving.
Self lives by getting and forgetting. Self is lovelessness. Love is selflessness.
And not getting and forgetting. Self is lovelessness. Love is selflessness. So, we must engage this self in holy activities. That is what Pipilada taught. We need to keep the self as the nature of the Atma. We shouldn't define self by saying, I am Ramayya, Krishnaya, Rangaya and so on. These are given names and bodies born in. Names given to the bodies that were born. But Atma was neither born nor is it a given name. We must consider this as self, which was neither born nor named.
So that was the next clip in that discourse. Swami takes on from the point where we were talking about rights and responsibilities, and from there Swami goes on to, you know, I mean, as we said, all of these descriptions that Swami was giving, it comes under what Swami was talking about as what are the required qualities for a student. You know, as we said, Swami is talking about 7 qualities or 6 qualities a student should have, about determination, about purity of purpose, and all of that comes under that. And Swami was talking about this, and in that course Swami says that it was with these kind of qualities that the 6 disciples of Pipilada go and approach him and ask these questions. And of course from there Swami goes on to say that, you know, this is how students should be. And Swami says students are good, and but it's the people who are guiding them, they are wrong. So there was a time when we were students and we would be gladdened to hear this, but I think now we are on the other side of the, you know, description.
And I think, like, you're seeing what an echo of what Swami had spoken about in the Kenopanishad, when Swami was speaking on the Kenopanishad, and Swami was again pointing out that our vision is directed outwards.
Right.
And that time, of course, Swami had said that all our senses are directed outward, and our attention being on the senses, therefore we are directing our attention outwards. And Swami says that it does us well that if we could also develop what Swami calls as the inner view. Right. Like, very often Swami would pun on the words. He would say, seek the inner view instead of an interview. But yes, so Swami, again, he's exhorting us same way, that what we need to cultivate is the inner view. And here, something that Swami has always said, no, outside, what is outside is a reflection of the inner being. As Swami would very often say, right, whatever you see outside, it's like a reflection, reaction, resound. He says there doesn't exist anything apart from what you create, you know, in that sense. Right.
Right.
In fact, I remember in one discourse, Swami, he clarified to a large extent what, see, often Swami would say in a discourse that what you see in the faults that you see in somebody else, they are also inherent in you. And for a long time I wouldn't understand, like, how is it, you know, how can that be possible, right? I see a lot of evil in somebody, or I can make out that somebody has evil intentions. That person has it, how come, you know, it's not in me. Then Swami then in one particular discourse, he said that if it were not in you, would you be able to recognize it in them? And that, you know, it totally fit. That's when I understood it. Like, because whatever degree is already present in you. So, which is why you're able to, as I said, you know, say, we're able to read a person's intentions. Or we're able to catch a person in a lie. Right? And the reason is that tendency, that characteristic is there to whatever degree, but it is there, it is present. like a baby, for example, wouldn't be able to read those intentions or even label it a lie, because a baby is, it doesn't know the concept of lie.
Like, you know, there was one discourse where Swami is talking about the purpose of the avatar, and Swami was kind of, you know, knocking down a few myths. So in that context, Swami is telling that people think that God comes to destroy the evil. Okay, and Swami says that, you know, that's a wrong approach. Because God does not see the flaw in you at all. Then how can he see you as evil and come to correct you? So he said God's approach is never like that. God only sees what's positive and what's the right thing in you, and it always, the focus of the divinity is always on that.
Yeah.
And he says, because God by nature cannot see the flaw in others. And we never think of this. I mean, we do agree with it theoretically, but then we still say that, you know, God comes for the punishment of the evil and for the rewarding of the good. So Swami said nothing like that. God only comes for rewarding of the good. And in the course of the thing, that, you know, the punishment is, it's a perfect system the God, you know, divinity has created. Bad gets bad as reward and good gets good as reward. But what God comes to give when he comes as an avatar is more than just a reward for goodness. It is something higher than that.
Right.
And, you know, so he doesn't see good and bad in you. So that way, as you were saying, that it's only in the flaw is in us that we see that. You know, many times I've thought about this, and in fact, some of our listeners have even asked this. This particular statement which Swami says, the flaw that you see in others is because you have it in yourself. And I remember one of the listeners had asked a question that, I see somebody stealing something. Okay, I see somebody as a person who is a thief. How can you say that I have the nature in me and that's why I'm recognizing him?
Yes.
You know, see, somebody being a thief or somebody indulging in an act such as burglary, it's an expression of a certain attitude which is inside. And that is basically when you, you know, rip away all the other paraphernalia attaching to that, you are talking about the nature of covetousness. What is not yours, what you have not yet earned, you have a desire for that.
Right.
And that's a very basic quality which is there in all of us. It expresses itself as different, you know, depending on the amount of control we have over our mind. But it's not necessarily if I see somebody as a thief, there is a thief in me.
Yes.
But that attitude of covetousness is there, you know, in me.
Yes.
And you have to recognize that. It's not about just that thief being in me.
Yeah. And in fact, somebody once pointed out and he said that if you ever notice that, okay, see, there are so many such what we call as evil qualities or vices. There are some which we see and we say, okay, let it be. And there are some which really gets us worked up, riled up. And that person said the reasons you get riled up or you get worked up are because you are upset that these are in you. And you already, you recognize that you have this weakness or you have this quality and you hate it being present in you. The moment you see it manifesting somewhere else, that hate which you have is what? So say, you see somebody who is lying, right? And you get worked up, right? Not for the sake that it hurts you, whatever. You just see somebody randomly lying and you get worked up. That's because you hate that about you. Right? If it weren't present to that degree, maybe you would just recognize it and maybe you just tut and say, like, it happens, you know?
The other thing that Swami was talking about is, you know, I mean, it's interesting because in different parts, Swami says that you have to be present in the situation, and Swami would often say that desha kala paristhiti, to have a certain amount of grip over what's happening around you is very, very important.
Yes.
And whatever you do, be it your duty, your response to the situation, cannot be possible if you're not aware of all of this. Because earlier Swami spoke about awareness. Swami said awareness is not just knowledge or information, but it's about an overall idea of the situation from different points of view. That's awareness. It's a 360 degree view. And here in this place, Swami is talking about, you know, you cannot be influenced by time and situation and the changes that happen with time and situation.
Right.
So I think what the idea which we have to remember is, what Swami would often say, that, you know, when you're talking about principles and all that, and even what Swami is talking about, discrimination, that should be beyond the changes of time and situation. That is timeless, right? But the way you choose and you decide to act in a moment, that has to be with a lot of pragmatism. You can't do away with that, you know, to be able to react to the situation, acknowledging what is happening.
Yeah, very appropriate to what is there, In fact, after this, Swami is then speaking about, I think, what is very relevant to youth and even people who are in the prime of their career. And Swami is speaking about, you know, how we, the intelligence or the knowledge that we gain through our education, what we do with it. Right? And Swami very often used to pun on this. He says, instead of skilling your intelligence, you tend to kill. Right? And I remember one interaction very early in my student life. Swami was asking me, so what is technology all about? And because I come from an engineering background, I was trying my best in different ways. I was trying to say that, you know, there is science. And then the application of that is technology. You know, some I couldn't come up with an answer. Then Swami was speaking about what technology is, and he said, you know, it seems like what you're all taught in your engineering classes is technology. Right? Swami would pun on that. He would say technology. And so it is like Swami was distinguishing what technology is and what technology is. And I think technology is where we use this technology to exploit the people around us.
Right.
You know, most of us, even when we, in a regular academic world, what are we trained in? As you mentioned some time ago, that there are resources out there and how much can we grab of it? And there is absolutely the present education system, I think it lacks that orientation towards the aspect of serving society using that intelligence, right? Using that technology which you learn.
Right.
Yeah.
No, talking about technology, and you know, Swami very often, as you said, refer to it as technology.
Mm.
I mean, even technology is an application of science, mm. right? As you said, science is abstract, and when science is, put to use in the service of, the society, it becomes technology. But you know why I feel why Swami is saying this technology is, it's almost like most of the time nowadays we use technology to kind of filter out what gives us discomfort and what gives us more pleasure or what gives us more comfort.
Right,
and that is actually a very, very dangerous thing.
Mm-hmm.
And Swami would say, there is always pleasure and pain is like a couplet. You can't separate them.
Mm.
You have to acknowledge that with pain comes pleasure, and I won't seek pleasure without pain.
Right.
But most of what we do in technology is trying to take any experience and filter out all the discomfort or pain which is there in it, and draw only the pleasure out of it. Many things. Simplest thing, if you think of what we do with our, let's say, our mattresses.
Mm.
How much more pleasure can you add in a mattress? What is that synthetic material which can give you more comfort and more softness or whatever it is? So it's all the time with the idea of how can I enhance this pleasure that I get from the world outside.
Right. And till at some point of time you have tricked yourself into thinking that you cannot do without it.
Yeah, you cannot do without it. Mm. And it's a classic case of separating pleasure from purpose.
Right.
And one of the best examples I can think of is what something like narcotics does to you.
Hmm.
Right? What they say is, you have a certain amount of happiness, and that happiness is always attached to some action.
Hmm.
Like you're supposed to do something and find that pleasure.
Yeah.
So when you get into this narcotics, what it does is it gives you that pleasure without doing that action.
Hmm.
So you kind of separate, what Swami says is pain and pleasure. You kind of just give a blast of pleasure, trying to do it without indulging in the pain part of it or in the struggle part of it. So after a period of time, there is that numbness. You kind of have had a saturation of pleasure, and you're not able to live even simple life with the pleasure that it offers.
Right.
And that's what we're doing. When Swami says technology, it's like misusing our knowledge to enhance pleasure in every very possible way in everything that we do.
Right. Right. And also this, using technology as a means of exploiting society. And I think the present present situation really, there's a huge contrast that is offered. Like I think very recently in the news, we saw this story of the EpiPen, for those who have allergies. They use what is called as the EpiPen. It's used to deliver it subdues the allergy. It's so that drug, it's manufactured by a company called Mylan Pharmaceuticals.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly last week or a few weeks before, they raised the prices by almost a factor of 2 or 3.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, this drug has been in existence for the past 60 years, and it has already, the patent is already expired. But what they do is, now a new innovation is, you change the way it is delivered. You convert it from a pill to an injection, or the way that injection is delivered, the dose, some small tweak, and
patent that.
And they patent that
process,
they perpetuate the patent a little longer, and in that much time they want to gouge whatever they can out of the market. And what happens is with some a drug like this, the demand is like price insensitive. I'm totally dependent on that drug, and if I have a allergy coming up or a asthma attack, for example, coming up, and I need a drug, and they can increase the price by 2 or 3 times, and I have no option but to keep buying it. Right. In fact, a couple of maybe 6 or 7 months ago, a similar episode. There is this Martin Shkreli with Turing Pharmaceuticals. Almost the same thing happened, almost by a factor of almost 500% increase in a very, very rare drug. Dapoprim it was called. And it was, there's like a very minority of the population that is completely dependent on it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they go through like unbearable pain. And this, that exploitation, it in the name of capitalism, you know, you say that this is a free market, and price gouging, it's such a you know, gray area. Nobody knows, you know, on which side of ethics does it fall. Do you let the market do its thing, or do you need to intervene? And because one thing I've seen with markets that you know, which resist intervention, you know, they say ultimately it will come back to an equilibrium, price equilibrium. But are we willing to pay the price, you know, when it comes to a few individuals who may, you know, are we willing to pay that price? Because the moral arc, it takes a very long time to correct itself when there is no intervention.
Right.
And that's a very strange, ethical dilemma out there. Right?
In many ways, in fact, what they speak about the packaged water industry.
Mm-hmm. You
know, many of the technology which comes into making water more and more palatable.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember when we were in university, we've had these environmental science workshops where we had these water experts come and speak to us, and they say most of what they say about, you know, it has got this treatment and that treatment and this level of purification, said all of that is superfluous. You don't need that in water.
Mm.
In fact, they said you don't even realize that sometimes the water is brown and even that water is palatable.
Mm.
You know, even that does not harm you, because what harms you in water are very, very few things, and only that has to be identified and removed.
Right. Boiling will...
boiling does the trick.
Yeah.
And even things like, you know, high fluoride content.
Yeah.
They said a nutritious food takes care of that.
Oh.
You know, when a very
right.
good nutritious supplements in your food
Got
takes
it.
Care of that kind of soluble impurities.
Mm.
And what they were saying is immense amount of technological investment has been made in some of these fields.
Mm.
So then they, you know, the lobby kicks in, and then you have this whole lot of advertisement blitz which happens where you're made to believe that it's so unsafe to drink water which is coming from your
yeah.
taps.
Yeah.
Right, and because that's the only way this technology can survive, and this technology can be pushed and made
Marketed.
Money from.
Yeah.
Right, you know, I mean, as we were saying, that is the problem with technology. It's not about nascently nothing seems to be wrong.
Yeah.
You know, everything is in its purest form seems to be harmless and helpful. In fact, but I think the human mind has this ability to make even anything.
The point that you're making, yes, in contrast. Technology can be and has been used in the service of society, you know, not merely for comforts. If you see, you know, in juxtaposed to the two examples that we saw just now, the polio vaccine is a classic example of where there were, in fact, what most people may not realize, there are actually two kinds of vaccines. Polio vaccines that were invented.
Mm-hmm.
Both the people who invented this, they gave up the rights on the patent. They said, we want this to be, to propagate all over the world. And that's why we see a polio-free, you know, world.
Mm-hmm.
Like India became polio-free maybe 3 years back, and I think Pakistan is limping towards that. But all this would not have been possible had... The original inventors. It's so amazing that both the inventors said we give up our rights on this. There are several others. If we look at the in cars we have the safety belt, right? Even that the design, original design, was developed by an engineer from Volvo, and he said, I mean, even he gave up the rights on the patent. He said, I want this for society, and that's why this feature, you see it ubiquitous in all cars right now, even in India. The reason is that, you know, otherwise the cost of this would have been far higher in royalties paid to Volvo. I mean, ultimately Volvo gave up the patent rights on that.
No, I mean, that really brings us back to what Swami was telling, that about skill and balance and knowledge.
Yeah.
You know, of course, very fond of that topic, because when Swami came here to inaugurate the studio, that is one thing which Swami very, very emphatically said.
Okay.
He said, you know, you all have gathered knowledge, because he was talking to students who had completed the studies and, you know, they were beginning a career. Swami said, you all have gathered knowledge, but now it's, you know, you have this opportunity of converting that knowledge into skill. And he said, knowledge gets converted to skill only when you think of how do I use my knowledge for the benefit of others.
Yes.
The moment you start thinking that way, you automatically start skilling your knowledge.
Mm.
And Swami said, when knowledge is brought to skill, and then it brings balance. Right? You know, when exactly what Swami is saying here. He said it brings balance, and only in that state of balance you will get insight.
Right. Okay.
Because you can have all the knowledge, you can have all the best intentions, but how do you know that you're progressing and you are, you know, moving towards the right direction? Because with all good intentions, you might be doing something wrong. I'm not sure of what it is, but Venkatraman sir used to tell a beautiful example of, you know, how they, in Northern America, they eradicated a particular kind of weed in some of these coniferous forests. And eventually what happened was there was one forest fire and thousands and thousands of acres of forest got burnt. And then they realized that this weed was actually, would control the fire to a great extent.
Right. So it is an integral part of the ecological,
the ecological system. You know, they just thought that probably this is a, it's a good thing that you're doing to nature by eradicating this weed. So how do you know that with the best of your intentions and with all the best of your knowledge that you have, you're moving towards the right direction? And that's what Swami says, you know, you knowledge to skill, skill to balance, and once that balance is there, insight will come. You will know which is the right direction to go, you know how far to go and when to pull yourself back.
Yes. I think the next part of the discourse is all about how does one get that balance in one's life.
Right.
I think like the Swami is speaking about the, of course Swami first cautions us as, you know, he gives the example of how what we are doing right now is we are climbing the shadow tree. Right? And Swami says that we are giving up what is real. We are giving up our sacred, you know, our divine identity, the truth of who we are. We have settled for a false ersatz version of who we are, and we are deriving happiness from that. You know, like it's like a, you're catching a bauble and saying like that is the gem, and you're finding happiness in that. Right? And then Swami, he, it's a very nice example, I think. No, the Swami speaks about if you climb the shadow tree, what you're going to get is shadow fruit. So look for what is a real tree to climb.
Yeah. I think what happens today is, you know, when you have everybody around celebrating the achievement of a shadow fruit, you know.
Wonderful point. Yeah.
You kind of are happy with that, you know, because we, let's say I achieve something in life today.
Yeah.
And I feel happy. I think that happiness is to a great extent real.
Yeah.
Because everybody seems to be celebrating the achievement of a shadow fruit, right?
Yes, yes.
And that's very important for us to kind of take this reality check and find out really what is that something, because I was talking to a friend of mine who's doing research in a Western country. He was saying, but everybody around here is happy.
Right.
You know, we were taught all that spirituality in college, but everybody here seems to be happy without that. Right? You know, that really kind of questions your beliefs sometimes. You know, how can they be happy? And I think that's why that at some point I was telling him that how is it that somebody who's living in probably one of the poorest villages in India seems to be as happy as the person in the country there?
Yes.
You have to ask this question and say that that means that this happiness seems to be independent of social security.
Precisely.
And, you know, there is something beyond all of that that is the source of this happiness.
Yeah. There's this novel called The City of Joy.
Right. Dominic Lepere.
Written by Dominic Lepere. And he writes about perhaps the one of the, you can call it the most wretched lives ever, and that of a living in a slum, and this was in Calcutta. There's one very nice episode that he speaks about, and this is a leper colony in Calcutta, and the lepers have kids, and maybe the kids ultimately do get infected, but this is what their life is. And there's, he says, he describes a small wedding that takes place, very simple wedding, and the, you know, the kids, they're all dancing, it's raining, and they're dancing in that, and he looks at the sparkle in their eyes, and that's when he realizes that joy can be found just about anywhere. You know, that leper colony, I think, was called Anandnagar, the city of joy. It derives from that, it's a translation of that. But I remember reading this when I was in my teens, and it really struck me. And very often, you know, people, these images, they people, you know, they share with you of how oftentimes it is the very, very poor people who are also the people who share the most.
Right.
Yeah, whether they're so sensitive, I've seen even in Prashanti Nilayam, sometimes you see the people who beg, it's like when they're given something, they share it with the people around them. It's like, it's not that they keep to themselves. And I've seen, like, even where that compassion even translates to the animals, you know, like, they're ready to share, like, if they get a piece of bread, they share half of that with that with that animal. You know, it's, you would think that in their situation, how can they be that generous? But it's finally, I really, it's at that moment that it hits you that divinity is present in any living being, because that love which you see, that kind of generosity, compassion, I think that can only come from a space of the divine.
In fact, I think that leads to the next theme which Swami is speaking here, but we won't go much into that, about you know, self-confidence and self...
Oh, that's a very important topic, I think.
What really struck me in that is, probably I'll just share that, you know, where Swami says, many times we've heard the Swami talking about the foundation, the walls, the roof and the house, where Swami would say that self-confidence, Swami says here, self-confidence is the foundation. And self-satisfaction is the walls that you raise, and self-sacrifice is the roof. I mean, the order is very, very interesting. Swami says, sacrifice is built on satisfaction.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
This is, I think, is a very, very important concept, because many of us sacrifice when we are bugged with life.
Yeah.
Right? You know, that sacrifice comes out of a certain amount of helplessness or
resignation
or when you're irritated with something, or, you know,
give up.
Even spirituality, that's what we think, because why do we think that we can come to it at the age of you know, when you're miles away from the grave, is because we believe that by then we would have got saturated by this, you know, would have got irritated with all life and we will have it. But Swami is saying that it comes from satisfaction, and when you're talking about this beggar sharing and happiness being amidst whom we consider poor, that happiness comes from a certain amount of satisfaction. And, you know, that is that satisfaction which kind of allows you to sacrifice. You know, when you're able to be self-satisfied, when you find the joy of self-satisfaction, and that's when you can sacrifice. It's not when you have enough and when you have plenty that you can part with what you have.
Right.
When you're able to be satisfied with what you have, then it becomes even more easy for you to give up what you have and, you know, sacrifice. I think that's what is the beauty of that order in which Swami says those things, self-confidence, self-satisfaction and self-sacrifice, leading to self-realization.
I think we need to explore this in greater detail. Right. I think like we did in this segment, we'll start with a... You know, we'll start with discussing about this and then move on to
the other part of the clip. Swami gives a lead on to the next part, because Swami says that all of these is dependent on the self. So self is the most important thing, and the next part focuses on what is the self and why is it important to focus on that.
Yeah, I think that's a real gear shift. That's what I experienced at that moment as Swami started speaking about this. Like, it's like the final lap is being run. No? That's the sense I got. Yeah.
So dear listeners, so that will be the wrap for this week's Shravanam Mananam Hridayasanam. We humbly offer this at Swami's lotus feet. If you have any thoughts to share with us, do send us your feedback. You can send it to listener@radiosai.org. Thank you very much for being with us. Do join us again next week, 7:30, for the next clip in that discourse. On behalf of all of us, we thank Swami for this opportunity. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the last segment of the day, Outside Inside, Deep Inside. Stay tuned. Jai Sainam.